Tonight, I'd like to explore with you a koan. And as many of you know, koans are one of the unique features of our Zen way. They are stories, they are fragments of text, bits of poetry that in one way or another encapsulate what we are trying to get at when we seek the great matter. And this koan, like so many of them, are about the encounter between a young student and an old roshi. And it's one of my favorites because it offers both profound understanding of the nature of reality and very specific pointers for how we should encounter that reality, how we should practice. So this is case 19 from The Gateless Barrier, which is Wu Men's classic collection of koans, and I'll read you the case and the verse that goes with it, and then we'll explore it a little. Zhao Zhou asked Nan Chuan. Zhao Zhou is the young student and Nan Chuan is the master. And Zhao Zhou asked Nan Chuan, "What is the way?" And Nan Chuan says, "Ordinary mind is the way." And Zhao Zhou asked, "Should I try to direct myself toward it?" And Nan Chuan said, "If you try to direct yourself, you betray your own practice." And Zhao Zhou asked, "How can I know the way if I don't direct myself?" Nan Chuan said, "The way is not subject to knowing or not knowing. Knowing is delusion. Not knowing is blankness. If you truly reach the genuine way, you will find it as vast and boundless as outer space. How can this be discussed at the level of affirmation or negation?" With these words, Zhao Zhou had sudden realization. And then there's a verse that Wu Men writes to say a little more. He writes, "Spring comes with flowers, autumn with the moon, summer with breeze, winter with snow. When idle concerns don't hang in your mind, that is your best season." So, you may, some of you who study koans will recognize Zhao Zhou as the great master in the first koan that we all study, the koan of Mu. So, this for the first koan is, by that time, Zhao Zhou is a much revered master. But here, he's an 18-year-old boy. And he lives in 9th century China, and he has left his home to go study with the great Nan Chuan. And when he asks, "What is the way?" he's going right to it. He's saying, "What is all of this about? What does it mean that the world exists, that we're all here? What's the meaning of life? What's the point of it all?" He's asking the question that brings most people to one spiritual tradition or another, to one religious practice or another, because all spiritual traditions try to deal with this question of what is all this? What's it about? What does it mean to be alive, to be human, to be here? And we can only imagine that Zhao Zhou is looking for some great, lofty answer, because many of the religious traditions, including in his day, gave great, lofty answers about gods, about realms that humans could never even begin to reach, about something outside that's loftier than, bigger than, perfect, untouchable. So when he asks this question of the great Zen master that he's entrusted himself to study with for years and years, Nanchuan says, ordinary mind is the way. I mean, just the word ordinary is radical. And how could that be? How could this mind, my mind, that's full of trivia and pettiness and old I Love Lucy episodes and all the ruminations of being a guy caught up in 21st century Boston. How could this ordinary mind be the way? So Nanchuan is saying this is something very different than other spiritual traditions will tell you. He's saying, do not look outside yourself for the absolute nature of all of it, of reality. And that alone is revolutionary. He's saying, nothing to look for outside yourself. Your mind is the way. You are the way. And in the Zen teaching, you are the Buddha. You are already the Buddha. Nothing to get, nothing to attain. And what does Nanchuan mean by ordinary? Well, he means that experience that all of us have had when we look really deeply at anything, that suddenly, when we look as though for the first time at the flame of a candle, at the patterns on the palm of our hand, at this rug, that suddenly, when we really, really look, without the shorthand of flame or hand or rug, but just really look, everything has an aliveness that makes it miraculous. Thich Nhat Hanh is famous for giving little children one raisin to eat very, very slowly. And all the children say, these are special raisins. Where did you get these? And of course, they're just ordinary raisins. But the children are asked to concentrate, as they never have before, on this tiny, miraculous little piece of dried fruit. And so, when we look at the ordinary with fresh eyes, everything has an aliveness that it didn't have. When we look at knee pain, when we look at sadness, when we look at a fight with our partner, when we really look, suddenly the same old has a vibrancy that it didn't before. And so there's that ordinariness, and there's the ordinariness of the mind that looks, of the mind that is full of shorthands and misconceptions and delusions and stories, and has this miraculous capacity for awareness that is truly the Buddha nature that we are all blessed with. But Zhao Zhou says, he hears this ordinary mind, that's it? That's all you got for me? And so he says, well, okay, so, because here he is, he's signed up to be at this monastery for years and years. He said, well, should I try to direct myself toward it? How do I do this? Should I try really hard? And Nan Chuan, in a very frustrating but very patient way, says, if you try to direct yourself, you betray your practice. Poor Zhao Zhou. I mean, where does that leave him? Then what's he supposed to do? And what does that mean anyway? And if you think about it, have you ever approached anything you wanted without making it a project of some sort? Have you ever approached something you saw and hoped you could have without trying to direct yourself? So what could this possibly mean? I mean, I notice actually that even though I've been practicing for years and years, I still find these little projects creeping into my zazen. In fact, as many of you know, I had a bad concussion. And for a while I was sitting unable really to direct myself. And I began to realize that subtly, usually I sit with an awareness of how far along I am in my 25-minute period. I think, oh, okay, now I'm about halfway through. Now I'm about three-quarters of the way through. And I never even realized it until I was in a state where I couldn't do that. And there was something actually quite wonderful about this floating quality, where there was no time, there was no beginning, there was no end. Sometimes a whack on the head can bring unexpected benefits. However, I don't recommend it. But what I notice is the ubiquitousness, the persistence of my project making. And Nan Chuan is saying, no, you betray your practice if you do this. Nan Chuan says, the way is not subject to knowing or not knowing. Knowing is delusion. Not knowing is blankness. So knowing, setting out to say, I'm going to really nail this period of zazen. I'm really going to know reality. I'm going to know my breath. Boy, I got this. That sets up the self in opposition to everything else. That it sets us up in that same deluded separateness that we live in, that we swim in all day long, that the world swims in now more than ever. This delusion of me versus everything else. Dogen talks about practice in a way that I find extremely helpful in this regard. He says, to carry the self forward and illuminate the myriad things is delusion. That myriad things come forth and illuminate the self is realization. So what Dogen and what Nan Chuan are talking about is this experience of simply being, of simply floating, of simply receiving what is. Something that is completely unusual in our lives. And that in the moments when we can do that, that self versus the universe dichotomy falls away, fades away. And there's just this. And that's when Nanchuan says, if you truly reach the genuine way, you will find it as vast and boundless as outer space. Because there is no separation. We are completely one with everything, with the carpet, with the flame, with the headache, with the monkey mind. And he goes on to say, how can this be discussed at the level of affirmation or negation? And with these words, Zhaozhou had sudden realization. And of course, we all wish we could get that. So if you work really hard at this, maybe you can get it. No. In fact, realization is those moments when self and other fall away, those moments when we can just be one with everything. Moments that we cannot plan, but that we can make ourselves more vulnerable to, if you will. And then Wu Men tells us that though Zhaozhou had realization, he could confirm it only after another 30 years of practice. So he gets sudden realization, and I'm sure he thinks, oh, I'm done, I got this. Actually, he studied for 40 more years with Nanchuan. And then when Nanchuan died, he went and studied for 20 more years with various teachers, and he didn't start teaching himself until he was 80. So what does it mean that it took him 30 years to confirm what he got in a moment in this episode with Nanchuan? Well, what we know is there is no final realization. There is no final enlightenment. There's no final resting place. We have these moments of sudden realization, of sudden aliveness, of awe. And then they fade. And then we fall back into our daily, messy monkey mind. And then another moment will happen. The sound of the rain will suddenly wake us up. Or the feeling of banging our knee. Or a phrase in the sutra book that we've read 100 times suddenly jumps out at us in a different way. And so these moments of realization occur over and over and over again in different ways. That's actually what koans can help us to do. That part of studying koans is to have a little taste of experiences that we have in life and experiences that we have on the cushion, affirmed by these characters, these people who were working on the same things 1,000 years ago. So this 18-year-old guy who's saying, come on, tell me, what is it? He's asking the same things that we ask, that I ask every time I sit down on my cushion. And how do I do this? And Wu Men then writes the verse that caps it all. He says, spring comes with flowers, autumn with the moon, summer with breeze, winter with snow. When idle concerns don't hang in your mind, that is your best season. And don't worry, idle concerns are going to continue to hang in your mind over and over and over again, because that too is Buddha. That too is it. That too is the true way. And so we move in and out of realization, delusion, all of it part of the Buddha way, and all of it expressing our own Buddha nature, which is already here. We've been expressing it all along, and rather than attaining some realization of it, we simply recognize what's been here for us in every moment. So then we're left with this lovely injunction from Sangsang in this moment is the koan. He says, just rest and cease, be cooled. Pass numberless years as this moment. This is like coming home and sitting at ease. So I wish all of you the joy of passing numberless years as just this moment. Thank you. So now please sit comfortably and hopefully you'll come forward with thoughts, reactions, impossible questions.
I'm interested in the other extreme that was mentioned there, the not knowing or blankness.
Yeah.
And what the problem is there. It seems in my mind harder to state or to
So he's talking about, so he says knowing is delusion, and I think that makes you get that. Right, so this idea that when we think we've got it, when we think we've fixed a piece of reality, we're usually telling ourselves some delusive story, and truly knowing reality is not something the mind can do. But then what's the not knowing is blankness. So I think he's working with the two sides of that we're always playing with, of form and emptiness. So in the world of form, I have to know how to turn on my car in order to get home, right? And I have to know how to come to the Zendo and sit down at a certain time in order to practice with all of you. So he's pointing to a world that we do have to live in which we say, okay, yes, knowing the true nature of reality is impossible, but there's some conventions I'm going to adhere to because it'll help me get through my day and get to practice, right? So I think that's what he's trying to do. He's trying to say we live on this edge of knowing and knowing that we can never really know in the deepest sense.
I was wondering if it could also mean being incurious.
Yes. I like that much better than what I just said. because curiosity is at so much the foundation of what we do, of
passion,
this practice.
Is one of the three.
Absolutely.
Forget the word that's used, but yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Great. Yeah.
And doubt, where we're constantly encouraging this kind of wait, what about this? Right? This kind of dialogue rather than just bowing down.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thank you.
I wanted to add on to that, that, you know, sometimes we talk about two different I don't knows, and one is the I don't know of Bodhidharma, but, you know, who is this who stands before me? I don't know. And then there's another I don't know that's just, I don't know. I think that's the one that you were talking about, and you know, that's what speaks to me also out of that.
Thank you, Bob. And this, as you know, is a favorite koan of mine also, partly because it harkens back to the Taoist roots of Zen. The word Tao is mentioned here. Ordinary mind is the Tao in some translations. But I was interested when you mentioned project, my project, the project that I bring to practice, because I noticed that I always have a project also. And even more than that, I notice this triad, which is the self that practices, a clearly defined practice, and a measurable result. At least that's what I'm looking for. And then, you know, when I notice myself thinking that way, I say, don't think like that. Don't think like that. But actually, you know, it's hard in the world of form to completely lose this triad, this sense of the I. It's really way below thought and words. And so, you know, not knowing is attractive because knowing, somebody at GBCC called it the department of delusive certainty. Mm-hmm. I just love that. We spend a lot of time in the department of delusive certainty. So not knowing seems like a viable alternative in some sense. And actually, in the Kwannon School of Zen, where I practiced for many years, don't know is the watchword. It's a kind of shorthand for practice. But actually, you know, I think it's just another project in some sense. That I can find my now my practice is don't know,
yeah,
and so that's what I'm doing, and so that will lead to some kind of result, and so the way I understand what you're saying about this koan is that it, you know, I think he is gently discouraging the how question, and I think I noticed this in many of our sutras and our texts. That the how question is discouraged just because it's not necessary to have a project, because really it's a question of the real situation. And I fall back upon the Heart Sutra, where it points out that, you know, the eye, the faculty of seeing, and the object seen, and all the senses in this sense, are not separate.
Right.
It's just
right.
One thing.
Right.
If it's just one thing, then I don't need an oar and a boat to get me there.
Yeah.
You know, so that's the way I understand it. But it's absolutely, in some sense, confounding, you know, when he says it's beyond knowing and not knowing. And you can see Jojo, you know, being taken aback as you pointed out. But fortunately, he gets it in the end, and then.
Yeah.
I hadn't noticed that part about how he works for 30 years after that.
You know, too, Pierce, that, you know, we're saying projects are bad, but in fact, projects are what our minds do, and so they're not bad. They are it also. They're part of reality. But I think what the koan points us to is that there is another place to be, that we can be. Where the projects fall away, and that's a very different way of being and knowing, and that can happen too, but that not to get rid of projects are just what they are, just to know them when you see them and let them be, and they'll pass and something else will come.
I'm going to continue to come, maybe not for 30 years, but
oh yeah,
I'll still be here.
Yeah, really. Well, apparently, Jojo lived to be 120.
Oh.
So, just, you know.
That's hope for you.
Yeah, really.
I think Bobby had
it. Yeah, Bobby.
Well, thank you for giving us the opportunity to dwell with this for a while. And what I find so reassuring about it is this message that we all have exactly what we need. Mm-hmm. Everything that we need.
Yeah.
And it leaves me with this great appreciation for the whole mess of what's
yeah.
here. And also the this particular approach to not knowing made me aware of how many times during the day I have to play a role in which I'm supposed to know. And I do it because it's called for in these situations for me to give some answer. And yet the whole time I know, I don't really know. And so there's, it's a great relief to rest in the permission of not knowing.
Yeah, yeah. That's so useful. Because I mean, here I am, I'm up here telling you I'm supposed to know, right? And I don't, right? And so, what we do is we can at least hear, mm-hmm. acknowledge with each other that we are just, you know, we're just all stumbling around trying to help each other, but to really say we know is to be spending time in the department of delusive certainty, mm-hmm. and sometimes we have to because people, you know, you're a physician, and sometimes people look to you to say, please tell me what to do. And so you play that role. But absolute knowing, no, we get it. Yeah, Dana.
I found when you're speaking, and when Pierce brought up the Heart Sutra, I think whenever I've said the Heart Sutra before, a lot of the, like, suffering, cause of suffering, cessation, path, like, I keep seeing them as opposites. But in the context of your talk, it seems to be one feeds into the other,
mm.
as opposed to them being like dichotomous. It seems to be like one is causing the other, and then you don't really get a start or an end. It's more like cessation, stop, path. It's not giving you like opposites. It's just listing them.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not. It's just listing them in pairs. It's not like one comes before the other. And I think that was kind of a different way of thinking about it. It's sort of like, you know, this is it. There you go. All of those things.
Yeah.
Listen that other thing.
Right.
Feed into each other.
Actually, it's wonderful to hear you say that because my mind often sets up those things in the Heart Sutra as this versus that. Because
mm-hmm.
that's what our minds do. But what you're pointing to is a place where that's not it. There's room for all of it. It's all just this.
Yeah. Just I think that usually I tend to turn it into something where it's pointing out, you know, all of these things are part of it, but in my head it's like one is like the start and one is the end, and maybe you go back and forth, but it's like, no, this is all one big continuum.
Yep.
Like there's a whole one big run-on sentence.
Oh, exactly.
And there's
yeah.
It's not necessarily one before the other. I mean, they are, but heck.
Reality is one big run-on sentence. I like it.
Yeah.
Carolyn.
Thank you, Bob. This is very provocative. For me, at least, and I think probably for a lot of people who've spoken tonight, sort of gets to the heart of some of the difficulties in this whole practice. So when you talk about not knowing and the kind of relief that comes from that, I think we can all feel like, okay, we don't actually have to know. In fact, we can't know. And that brings a lot of relief with it. The not doing is much harder. It's like, what do we do now that we don't know? Or how do we get to that point? Or, you know, what's the technique for sitting with or examining that? And I'm always looking for that. And I'm supposed to do something with this now. I've had this realization, or I have this sense of, what do I do? And I'm going to ask my teacher, okay, what do I do with this? And you don't usually get much of an answer. Or sometimes they'll give you an answer, like, you know, more like the kind of beginner's mind idea rather than ordinary mind. You know, look at it freshly, look at it from this side, look at it from that side, you know, sit with it. And I think when you were talking about it early on, I was thinking, okay, are beginner's mind and ordinary mind the same thing? Are they just two translations of the same term? Because to me, just hearing it, they feel very different. Ordinary mind is what I'm sitting with when all these, you know, my shopping lists are going through my mind, my schedule for tomorrow morning, and I think, this is not what I'm supposed to be doing. And then I flip sometimes into ordinary mind, and I realize, I don't think I noticed this so much before, it's because it's like a technique. Now I know what I'm supposed to do with that. I'm supposed to look at it with a fresh eye and, you know, sit with it, stay with it. But it is another trap in the sense that it is a technique. Now I know what I'm supposed to do with whatever came up. So I don't know whether they're actually are supposed to be the same thing, but for me, they sort of represent almost opposite poles of what I think of as my waste of time, and then I kind of wake up and I have a way I'm supposed to deal with what I was thinking of as my waste of time. It's easy to get trapped in all of these things, no matter how meaningful they seem, to turn it into a method, a project, whatever it is.
I think you're pointing to one of the real paradoxes of practice. You know, that if we just sit down and, you know, play video games in our head or do what, you know, or go through Game of Thrones plot lines, you know, what are we doing, right? So you're right. There is an and making it an endless project is betraying our practice. So it is this constant sort of nuanced, paradoxical back and forth between not directing the mind and trying to come back from monkey mind, wandering mind. And and it's one of the things that has plagued great Zen masters for centuries. Dogen's big question that he traveled from Japan to China with was, if I'm already enlightened, why do I need to practice? You know? And that's a form of what you're just talking. You're talking about a specific form of his big question.
Sometimes, actually more than sometimes, one of the things I work with my students with on writing is that they, you know, think that they have to write in this academic way, and they tie themselves up in knots, and they use all these abstractions, and they say things, you know, they write things they would never say, and you can barely fight your way through it. And I say to them, just use your ordinary voice. And, you know, it's the point being that it's not easy sometimes to find that ordinary voice, and I think of ordinary mind in a similar way. That all the shopping lists and things, you know, that's like all of the stuff we put on top of our ordinary mind. And so there is some for me, there is a lot of resonance between beginner's mind and ordinary mind.
Kind of on that note, I've been thinking about the forms, and to what extent do I, because when you walk in, especially when you walk in, but there's a place to sit, there's a way to hold your hands, and you have your back a certain, you know, don't slouch, and ring the bell a certain way, or, you know, and to what extent does following, you know, and where is the edge of following the forms, you know, wrap your bowls up, and doing it way too, pursuing it too much, which I kind of get from that koan too.
Right.
Give me tips.
Tips. Wow. Well, and you know, there's huge debate in Zen. I mean, there are Soto schools where they are so into the minutiae of exactly what exactly how you hold your chin, and you know, and exactly the way that you tie your samurai top, and all these things. And Orioki is just a nightmare. You know, Melissa Blacker went to Soto Zen School to learn all this, and she said she cried for 8 days, that it was just it was so intense. On the other hand, we use these as containers to show us aspects of how we relate to the world of form, right? And so having no form leaves us kind of more loosey-goosey and doesn't allow us that vehicle for practice. Having too much form makes some people burst into tears for 8 days. So there, you know, I think we find, and American Zen is trying to define something different from traditional Japanese and Chinese practice. And so we're all, I don't think there is no last word on form. There's simply the understanding that form can be a vehicle for awakening because it shows us something about how we react to this kind of structure. But there's no one answer. Well, should we say our four vows?
He bows around the last page of the sutra book.